This is Whitley Strieber, and this is Dreamland. You've reached the edge of the world. Today on Dreamland, we have a guest who is going to take us down deep into the UFO rabbit hole, which is a place I love to go, and I'm pretty sure you love to go there too, or you wouldn't be here. We are going to be exploring all sorts of things from Project Sign and Project Grudge to the truth about Kenneth Arnold, the first UFO sighting. There's some missing information that's very, very important. Our guest has been deeply involved in things like the Rockefeller Disclosure Project. He has had a lot of thoughts about the challenges that we're up against right now. And without further ado, I want to introduce him. Keith Thompson is with us. He is the author of The UFO Paradox, which is a big, complex, wonderful, super interesting book that covers, Keith, it covers the waterfront, actually. It really covers a lot of things. So, welcome to Dreamland.
Well, it's great to be back in Dreamland, Whitley, and again, a chance to see you again. We've spent a little bit of time in person, and here we are again online. So what a pleasure.
Right. Yeah. The last time you were on, it was February of 2022 for, I believe, Angels and Aliens.
Is that yes. It? Yes. My first book was called Angels and Aliens, which is still available, but it's a used book. And I don't get any royalties from it. It's not in print anymore, but it was my first foray into this subject.
Okay, so, well, let's go back. That's a good beginning to the UFO paradox. By the way, Keith's website is thompsonatlarge.com. That's thompsonatlarge.com. And let's go back to the beginning. You become entangled, you become interested, and it has something to do with J. Allen Hynek and the swamp gas explanation.
Exactly. Let me tell you that story. I've been at this a long time only because I got at it at a very young age. I was 12 years old when it was my turn to give a current events report in my sixth grade class. And I lived in Northwest Ohio, neighbor of the state of Michigan, which at the time was the site of a remarkable set of sightings near Hillsdale College. And it was multi-day UFO sightings, lights, objects, very credible, very compelling. And the so I decided to report to follow this for a few days, knowing that it was my turn soon to come to class with clippings. And we could choose any story we wanted. I found this fascinating. I knew nothing about UFOs. My father was an airplane pilot. We were an aviation family in a hobbyist sense. So I did a lot of flying as a passenger, but never had thought about the UFO phenomenon. So J. Allen Hynek, as you know, the Air Force consultant, came in, flew into Michigan, and did an investigation. He went around to all the different sites, and finally, it's time to give a news conference in the old days. So he walked up to the front of the auditorium with the members of the press with their tape recorders ready to catch what he had to say. And he made an offhanded comment that he couldn't account for everything, but at least in one of the locations near the edge of town, near a mossy bog or a swamp, in that case alone, it could have been, might have been an instance of swamp gas, which is a real natural phenomenon in which decomposition of natural materials results in luminescence. He was mortified, Whitley, to watch the reporters jump up in the middle of his news conference, run outside to the bank of payphones, call in this report. Air Force dismisses sightings as swamp gas.
It's a famous story. And the question is, why would the media jump on it like that? And of course, he regretted it for the rest of his life. And they jumped on it because they were scared, and it was funny, and it turned a threatening situation into something you could laugh at. I think that's what
you could laugh at. You could domesticate it. You've taken a wild wolf and you turn it into a domesticated chow chow, or whatever you want to call it. I mean, it's turned
it maybe, into maybe the most pleased of all would have been that wolf, who would have thought, ah, how convenient. Now I'm wearing a swamp gas coat instead of my actual wolf pelt. swamp gas clothing.
Well, so he saw what had happened, and I reported on this in my report in class, and I simply said, this was a remarkable thing because this did not match what the people were reporting. So one of my classmates said, well, do you think it's aliens from outer space? And I even then thought that was a big jump. I knew that was an interpretation. And I said, well, I don't know, but it certainly didn't resemble what the people reported. Did not resemble swamp gas. You know, the people of Michigan's response to this, we may be rural, but we're not rubes. We weren't born yesterday. And that was part of the joke. Let's make fun of the people of northern Michigan. But again, it wasn't Alan Hynek who was making fun. And it was not, he did not say all of these were swamp gas. But he was misunderstood, misquoted. And I got an experience through giving this presentation class. One of my classmates said, well, then what do you think it was? And I said, well, I don't know either. And Willie, that wasn't a punt. I was 12 years old. I didn't have a need to know, or I didn't have an overriding need to sound authoritative. But again, I emphasize, sure doesn't sound like swamp gas or the other all-purpose explanation, weather balloons, which was soon to come into the picture. So my teacher said, I think what Keith is saying, class, is it's important to keep an open mind and ask relevant questions. Well, I can tell you that had a defining experience on me.
You had a good teacher, Keith.
I had a good teacher because I felt seen. I came from a family where I was not outvoted. I wasn't shouted down. We were allowed to express our opinions and encouraged to. But I had never really had outside my family that kind of I called it a benediction later. I was like a blessing for an adult to look at me as an aspiring adult on my way to being an adult and said, you have something to contribute. You have something to say. And so I continued to pay attention to this phenomenon, especially this dynamic. Ordinary, credible, responsible people report incredible, remarkable, magical, if you will, phenomena. But they do it coherently. Then the
official dates, Keith, when was this? When were you?
This was 1966.
66. Okay. So, you're a little boy still. Darn it. Everybody's younger than I am until finally I have returned to from whence I came. Any case, well, you'll reach me. You will reach me and hopefully beat me one of these days. we have a situation where you have been engaged by something you've read. Did you ever have any UFO sightings or anything at that period in your life?
Never had. We did a lot of flying. I didn't even know to look for them. I never got a chance to ask my late father whether he had seen anything that seemed out of the ordinary. He did teach me to pay. I got a love of the open skies from my father. He'd say, Keith, you want to go for a plane ride? I had three brothers, and we all took turns, but sometimes it goes as a group. But sometimes he'd say, Keith, want to go for a ride? Going to the airport. So I got to sit in the co-pilot seat of a two-engine plane, and he had some work to do usually. It was his business as well as something he did for fun. But I learned to pay attention to the open sky and to find the wonder and mystery, but never had any UFO experience. I have had, you know, I can't say I've never seen anything in the sky that was extraordinary because I had, and that is 2 years after this little report in school. I had a practice, a retreat that I would take. I would climb onto the top of our house roof, the roof of our house. We weren't allowed to do this. I'd go up the TV antenna. We had a fixed antenna built into the ground. You remember those kind? And it was like a ladder to the stars. So, you know, the song up on the roof, when this old world starts getting me down. So I would go to the roof and I'd lay down and I would find solitude and peace. And one day, age 14, While laying back on the roof with no aim or purpose in my mind, looking into the beautiful blue sky on probably a summer day, there was a moment of brilliant flashing through me. And I was suddenly everywhere at once, nowhere in particular, with a sense of something so extraordinarily right. And as if I had seen through the maze of things and was amazed at this sense of unbelievable, indescribable presence, stupendous presence.
Keith, we have to take a break here. We take a couple of breaks in the first half hour, and we'll just take a break. We'll be right back, folks. And when we do get back, we're going to go deeper past the moment of realization that this is a bigger world that Keith has been so beautifully describing, into the mysteries of that bigger world. We'll be right back. We're talking to Keith Thompson, his book, The UFO Paradox. ThompsonAtLarge.com is his website. And before we left for the break for the Free Dreamlanders, we were talking about a numinous experience, basically, of connection with what I suspect was probably conscious light from the sky, that it changed you deeply, obviously. And then at the same time, this isn't a UFO experience, but it is maybe something that triggered something deep within you, because you became very interested in all of these questions about UFOs and so forth. What mythological literature, for example, and historical findings struck you, made this feel, got into under your skin?
Well, I'll get into that. Let me just finish just one detail on this. I climbed down from the roof that day, and I suddenly knew that this was a world, a universe, a cosmos of purpose and meaning, and that that had to include myself, and that my life was meaningful in a way that I had never considered. And my family was not an overtly religious family. We went to church periodically, but it was more from the standpoint of good people. It's good for good people to be seen going to church, you know, for social reasons. I had no real orientation to religious teachings, but I came down from the roof that day and I said, I've been to center court. I've seen the heart of things. This is God country. This is what people talk about when they speak of God. At the same time, Whitley, because we didn't come from an overtly religious family, this wasn't something I was going to go into the house and tell my mom and dad, hey, guess what happened outside staring into the sky? No, it wasn't anything I was ashamed of. It was a sense of having known something deeper and that other people must be in on this too, a kind of secret knowledge. So with that in mind, I started to pay attention to spiritual literature. As I got older, I read Alan Watts, the great Christian Anglican who did so much in terms of popularizing the Eastern cultures of meditation and Buddhism, and read existentialist writers. And
yeah, I know Alan Watts' work well, of course, and I'm sure a lot of our listeners do too. I want to ask you, though, to move on to the Kenneth Arnold sighting that you've got some quite interesting thoughts about. Like the swamp gas explanation, which the media leapt at, something went profoundly wrong with the Kenneth Arnold sighting. What was that?
Well, he was out looking for a downed plane, a Boise, Idaho pilot, and suddenly saw out of his cockpit nine amazing objects flying in formation, which he later described as moving like saucers, as if they were skipping over water.
But not as saucers.
He didn't describe them as saucers. He didn't say they were shaped like saucers, but a reporter on the site, you know, picked up the saucer image. So Arnold had described flying saucers, according to them. So flying saucers were seen. It's not to say that he described them as flying saucers and that's why they were seen, but it was the primer, it was the origin story, the creation myth of modern UFO sightings was the Arnold sighting, if you want to call it, an informal creation myth. And it established the paradigm. He actually described them as shaped like stingrays. So, of course, then history evolved. The flying saucer movement and UFO movement began. People began to report extraordinary sightings. That's one thing that his did, Whitley, which is to empower people to report on what they were seeing as well.
Right.
Interestingly, decades later, his daughter, Kim Arnold, came forward after father was gone and said, gave an interview. And this is what she told the reporter. She said, my father was always struck by how he was assumed to have reported mechanical hardware, high-tech stuff in the sky. It was nothing like that. My father said these objects were living and breathing and moved the way the human heart would move. And then here's something I know that you will relate to, Whitley. She said, my father believed they had something to do with another dimension. And the dimension is where we go after we leave this world, is an otherworldly phenomenon. And of course, he didn't say that at the time. It was enough to report the objects moving like saucers. So yeah. In fact, imagine if he had stepped down from the cockpit and said, well, I've seen nine beings, blue-white beings with various densities changing their shape and form, breathing like the human heart, he probably would have had to pass a psychiatric test to get his license renewed as a pilot. He kept that to himself. But imagine if that had been the creation story of UFO research instead. As you know, it does correspond to a continuing esoteric or spiritual philosophical, eschatological is the word that theologians use, having to do with final things, deep mysteries of birth, death, transmigration of the soul. And of course, I remember so well, you're reporting so often, the day your late wife Ann came out of the office at home and said, Whitley, this has something to do with what we call death.
Yes, exactly.
This phenomenon that people are writing us about.
And we have so now the a Arnold situation. Story, Go ahead.
Yeah, the Arnold story is not gotten right.
We have a situation where first this is converted from it becomes something, a flying saucer. Now, the thing that's fascinating about that, he obviously did not see flying saucers. He saw something else, but that doesn't mean that's all that's here. Because I've got some video of UFOs, of flying saucers, that is excellent and real. I'm just making a note. I want that to show up in the show. And this video is of a flying saucer, clearly. So they are out there. But I think what he saw was many ways more remarkable because of his belief that it was something alive and that it had to do with the world of the dead. My wife, Anne, we have to take another break now. Free Dreamlanders, thank you so much, as always, for staying with us through the break. And we're going to probably advertise some of my books. And why don't you go on Amazon and just do that, get some books and maybe even subscribe to this website so you don't have to hear these anymore. We're talking to Keith Thompson, his book, The UFO Paradox. ThompsonAtLarge.com is his website. We have been talking about the creation of the UFO myth. And the fact that it kind of went sideways from the beginning because of fear and laughter and confusion. But I want to move on now, if I can, to something that happened in Zimbabwe that you know a lot about, the aerial school sighting. I remember the morning that phone rang, and it was John Mack, and he says to me, "Whitley, I just found out about the most incredible UFO sighting in history." And he told me about the aerial school, and he said, "I'm going to Africa." And he went and called me back afterwards and said, "I have got incredible video of these people. This is the UFO sighting. So why don't you tell us about it?"
Well, one morning in 1994, I'm pretty sure about that, at a school called the Aerial School, private school in Zimbabwe, the children were at recess. They saw a craft, an apparent craft. I use the word apparent because we really don't know what these are, or what they seem to be, or what they're wanting us to believe they are. But they certainly appear to be craft and creatures stepping outside. Now, in one sense, it had all the elements of a realistic event. This event, the craft seemed to be in space. It seemed to occupy a point in space consistent with geometry. It was seen throughout Zimbabwe that day. And at the same time, it had surreal effects. The creatures, or the beings, aliens, if you want to call them, that stepped outside of the craft, and they would walk forward, and then they would walk backwards as if it was being replayed. They'd walk forward again and then walk backward in a kind of staccato step. A young girl named Emily Trim looked at the creature, and the creature looked back at her through deep black eyes, and there was a deep moment of knowing between the two. Let me just at this point pause and say, I look at the phenomenon in terms of Joseph Campbell's three stages of initiation: separation from ordinary reality, a vast middle range of betwixt and between, in which you're no longer who you used to be before the separation, and you're not yet who you will be when the journey is complete. Well, instantly, this young girl was suddenly now in the betwixt and between, in the marginal realms, a transition between who she used to be. It happens that her family was a Christian family. And even though this is widely seen by many other children and other reported throughout the community, her parents said, in effect, "Emily, these things don't happen. We're Christians, so we don't deal with this sort of thing. It didn't happen. You didn't see it. Things will get back to normal." That is so, as you know, consistent with the various ways in which the collective mind reasserts this is the way things really are. But she went through a long period in this marginal space, and only when she got a letter 25 years later, I should say, others in Zimbabwe said, "Hey, Emily, we're going to have a reunion to celebrate the school's 25th anniversary," I believe it was. "Would you like to come back?" And that, Whitley, was her calling. I use the theme calling throughout this book. I view the UFO phenomenon and similar phenomena as callings from the cosmos, as news from the universe, that there's more here. So she went back to Zimbabwe, met a local elder who said, "Come to visit me and we'll talk." And he said, "So you're struggling with this?" And she said, "Yes, my parents have told me not to talk about it." And he said, "Well, you must talk about it. The children have these things right. And you saw this as a child, and you haven't been doing well by not talking about it. It's time for you to come forward, and I give you whatever permission you need to do that." That was an extremely empowering moment for her, as I'm sure there was a similar moment for you when you had to wrestle with, do I come forward with this? Well, so I'll just pause at this point and see if there's anything we want to.
Yeah, okay. Well, it's a critical moment in a human life. It is an initiatory moment. You were speaking of initiation previously, and at the time, I found my experience so interesting. I had gotten past all of the fear and confusion by the time I started thinking about making public statements about it. And unfortunately, being me and being a little out of touch with sort of the mainstream, or at least I was, I don't think I am anymore, but I didn't realize that this had a lot of sort of social and cultural baggage connected with it. I thought it was just an interesting story, and Anne was thought I should write it out because she said it's certainly the most interesting thing I've ever heard happening to anyone. And we thought that Bud Hopkins thought it was maybe 50 people in the whole country that had had this, or 100 maybe at most. We didn't know it was tens of thousands, none of us. And when the book, it felt like the book exploded in my face. So I know exactly where she was coming from. Now, there's something about, and I don't know if, I don't recall, I'm trying to think back on the on your book, on the UFO Paradox. Did you mention the fact that there was a very sacred area near there where the spirits of the dead are believed to reside?
I did say that. And as a matter of fact, when she went back for the, when young Emily, no longer young, she was 8 years old at the time. Now she's 20 something, and her life had not been going well by living with this secret and keeping it inside. She came back, and for the first time when she came back to the school, they said, would you like to go see one of the local wisdom elders in the Aboriginal, the indigenous culture? She said, yes, and how have I not done that before? We were here as colonialists, in a sense. We never interacted with the local community, the local indigenous culture. So yes, she went back and she met with the local wisdom figure, the elder, and told her, you must come forward with this. But yes, it was, it is related to those, to those kind of geographic, the burial grounds and so forth. But she never had that context with which to evaluate it. And the prevailing context was her family's Christian, Christian interpretation, and a kind of Christian interpretation that said, no go, we don't go there. This is not good. Right. It's not in the Bible, or whatever versions.
Well,
of that.
That's true in many of many people who work within the government on this, that we ignore this because you're supposed to ignore demons. And that's, I think, one of the reasons that so much of the record, so many of the records have been lost, because well, like, for example, the entire output of all records from the Roswell Army Airfield from 1947 to 1952 were apparently illegally destroyed. And as Congressman Stephen Schiff found, and the motive behind that in part is a religious motive. Free Dreamlanders, we have come to the end of your time with us. And I would like to thank you as always for watching. And I do hope you come back next week. As always, also, this is going to be a good show next week. And Keith is doing a wonderful job today. His website is keithisthompsonatlarge.com. You can engage with Keith there. The UFO Paradox is the new book. It is a deeply researched, very, very smart book that will open all kinds of doors in your mind and explore some tremendously interesting questions about so much more. I mean, we haven't even covered yet most of it. We've got still a lot to talk about. Robert Bigelow and the alien abduction question of the difference between the Bud Hopkins approach and the Dave Jacobs approach, the future of reality and what that means, and what is phenomenology as opposed to the scientific method. We've got loads to do. So subscribe to unknowncountry.com and you can listen to it all. Subscribers will keep right on keeping on. Okay, Keith. Now, so we have a situation here where Kenneth Arnold's daughter says that he related this in some way to the world of the dead. There is an important burial ground, a sacred space near the aerial school where actually the UFO landed, quite close to that sacred space. And Ann Streber found in the communion letters many instances of relationship between the dead and the visitors. And at our cabin, the dead would often show up in the context of close encounters with what looked to us like aliens. Okay, well, I've got three words for you. What's going on?
Well, in your own abduction, do I recall correctly that you saw aboard the dwelling or whatever the place you were interacting with these beings, or at some point you saw others, and it included.
I wasn't aboard it. It was before. I saw a friend.
Yes.
Who turned out to be? I discovered after I was doing research into this. That he had been dead when I saw him. He'd been dead since the previous March when I saw him in December. And there's something going on here.
Well, and so let's go back to there's a detail I haven't touched on with the Kenneth Arnold sighting. So that day, after he'd been talking to the press and used the word saucer, he flew back home from Mount Rainier, which is where he saw these nine objects in flying formation, flew back to his hometown of Boise, Idaho, drove from the airport to his house, and that night, for the first time, the house was filled with orbs of light of the kind that are frequently reported in relationship to this phenomena of the dead, phenomena of the paranormal, deathbed visitation, the orbs of light that are seen very often in relationship to craft. It turns out also his wife had some beliefs of an esoteric nature, had some beliefs about reincarnation. But these phenomena, on the same day as he saw something that was supposedly external to him, was already a connection to him and his life in a way that certainly must have eventually reinforced his thinking. This has something to do with another dimension. And the question, is it from outer space or other dimensions? There's no experimental way at this point to determine whether that it's one or the other, or whether it is not both in some way. We haven't understood.
It must be both.
Yeah.
Of course it's both. Because, you know, we have bodies. We have physical bodies at Fort Detrick in Maryland. I'm pretty sure they're there. In fact, unless they've been moved, they are there. At least three of them, and probably more, and more at other places. And the biology has been studied extensively for years, and they're not human. Yet at the same time, that doesn't mean that that's all this is. Because whatever they are, their relationship with the soul and with the whole world of what we think of as the dead. And Annie always used to joke that we are, the world of the dead is real. We're in it. In any case, it's a perfect example. It's what happened at the cabin. Lori Barnes is walking down the road one afternoon, and she encounters her brother, who disappeared 20 years before and has been dead probably for years. And the FBI has even declared him dead. So, and there he is standing there talking to her. But all he says is that he's fine. He wants her to know she invites him, says, "Oh my God, come down and see my friends." And to the cabin. And he says, "I just wanted to come and tell you that I was fine." And then Anne says, when Laurie comes staggering into the house and tells this story, she says to me quietly, "The visitors will be here tonight." And they did come. That's exactly what happened. They came to see Laurie and Raven Dana and a whole bunch of people. And the little gray aliens who were physical beings. And there's a connection there. You see what I mean?
Oh, I very much do. And let me now touch on the first most famous abduction case, Betty and Barney Hill. We certainly can't go deeply into that, but there's some aspect of it that I'd like to talk about. Namely, in that case, too, they were driving home. Something seemingly from outside their car interacted with them. And you can read my book to find out what, or you can Google that case. Here's a part that we don't know much about. Similar to the Arnold case, during the time that the aftermath of the abduction, in the Hill home, Betty and Barney Hill home. They would come home and find evidence of what seemed to them strongly poltergeist activity. All the clothes had been taken out of the closets. There were bumps. There were things moving across tables. Classic paranormal, parapsychological. These terms don't do it justice. I'm not a fan of the term paranormal. It implies maybe a little bit normal. I think paranormal refers to the largest frame of a phenomena, not some minor side effect of phenomena. But in any case, if that was never reported, so it whatever the agency they interacted with that night was also manifesting in their home as these kinds of mind in matter type effects. And that's one of the fundamental things I deal with in the book. The paradox, the UFO paradox, is this is a phenomenon that transgresses the supposedly clear, unbridgeable divide between mind and matter. In Western philosophy, Western science, mind and matter are separate categories. We have a fundamental dualism, and that there can be no non-local effects of the kind that there's massive evidence for in the parapsychology research. This phenomenon didn't get the memo on that, Whitley. It didn't get the memo that it's not allowed to do what it is. Nature does what it does. What's coming up short is our maps of nature. One of the things I always say, when there's a consistent body of research that is consistent, is coherent, is reported by credible researchers, UFOs, abductions, near-death phenomena, paranormal experiences, if they consistently show up with observers from various backgrounds, then at some point, and it's not on the maps, when new territory develops and it's not on the maps, there comes a point where a truly interested empirical observer says, maybe it's the maps. Has anyone checked the maps lately? Are our maps of science and reality up to date? I argue that they're not. Nature is entirely up to date. It doesn't present us with anything new. It's that we have decided for the past 300 years in the Western materialist empirical tradition to say that whole territories that we don't believe in don't exist. Well, again, if they don't get the memo, they'll continue to exist. They will continue to show up in the lives of ordinary people. And that's, I think, where we are.
This question of ontological shock is huge, because we're in a situation where we are very, very focused on the material world. And because it's our material world is so rich, there's so much there, from the new car to AI to this to that. We are constantly going out there, and in here is kind of starving to death. There's no in here, there's no there when it comes to the soul. But what you said is so important, because this experience, nature's not like that. And this experience is telling us basically to recover our relationship with nature, I think. How do you respond to that?
Well, there's a lot to go at there. John Mack, as you know, the late Harvard psychiatrist who put his career on the line, nearly got shut down by Harvard for daring to ask fundamental questions about this. He didn't coin the term ontological shock, but he popularized it. As you know, Whitley, and most of your listeners know, ontology is the field of philosophy dealing with the nature of being. Ontological has to do with the nature of reality itself. When you have an ontological shock, you've dealt with something. It could be the death of a child, the death of someone other very close to you, a natural crisis, a natural disaster, or an encounter with another level of reality that is so remarkable that you dare not tell anybody, including the near-death experience. So the ontological shock with this phenomenon is that we are encountering stuff that's not supposed to exist. This might be an opportunity for us to touch on some of the abduction research. As you know, I talk about some of the, I think, unfortunate blind spots of some of that research. I am not a debunker. I'm a critic. I'm a critical thinker about this phenomenon. I think the abductions are real experiences. And I noted in the book that one of the researchers, David Jacobs, for whom I have respect, he put his career on the line as a Temple University historian to go after this subject. He made very clear in one of his books, and I write about this, he said, well, in choosing what is a real abduction, I made sure, he said, to remove anything to do with spiritual things, telepathy, clairvoyance. These things are very speculative, and they get in the way. People who've had real abductions like to frame them as spiritual experiences. I don't bring that stuff in. And I thought, well, what you don't realize you're doing, Dr. Jenkson, this is called selection bias. You're removing from the pool of inquiry whole ranges of stuff because it doesn't fit your own materialist bias. You're trying to get abductions taken seriously. That doesn't require dismissing, for example, that many abductees report past life experiences. Jacobs didn't believe. He said, that's purely metaphysics. That's philosophical and spiritual. But actually, there's very good research. As you know, Dr. Ian Stevenson, the late Dr. Stevenson, did some very good empirical research on past life memories. So the field has unfortunately tended to hamstring itself by doing exactly what you're saying, because the inner world is so hard to understand in a materialist culture. Let's emphasize the way in which this seems to be consistent with a physical definition in a way that reinforces the split between the inner and the outer. I continue to say this is a phenomenon that is crossing the bridge between the physical and the inner, if you will. So I respect Dr. Jacobs. I respect Bud Hopkins, who had some of the same biases. He told me, he said, I don't want to have anyone tell me that we need a multidimensional model. I said, yeah, don't you think that some of the abduction experiences might be more intelligible if we had a more dimensions, if our science would open to the possibility that there might be more dimensions here all the time? He said, we have all the dimensions we need, he told me. And I thought, you know, ironically, Whitley, as I thought about that later, he said that to mean we don't need more dimensions than we have. And I agree. We may have more than three dimensions of space and one dimension of time. We have all the nature is not inventing new dimensions. We're learning more about the dimensions that are already part of nature. And hopefully we'll start including them in our maps so that we're not blindsided, soul blind, as you say. Why would we declare, if this is a crime scene, as Bud Hopkins and David Jacobs referred to it at one point, why would we rope off with yellow tape? We're not going to look at anything that's called metaphysics. But we don't fully understand what metaphysics refers to, except that it has to do with aspects of reality that we claim are only metaphysical, which is a way of saying aren't real. So I'm in favor of expanding the map, but at the same time, always using critical thinking and checking our belief structures, our belief systems.
Well, I think you're onto something here, because we don't have a situation where, where our culture, especially in the West, has so focused itself on one aspect of reality that it really isn't capable of dealing with this ambiguity that you're bringing into it. What it's to us is an ambiguity, but it's not necessarily an ambiguity. Going way back to that moment when you were 14 years old and you had an experience of the numinous. That is something that's arguably should be part of every life, but it's not, because you didn't come away with a belief about it. You only came away with the experience. Now, if you had been a strong Christian, you would have come away with the decision that it would have been an angel or more likely a demon. I mean, that's something they always seem to decide, that anything unusual is demonic. Like a lot of the Air Force officers believe this is demons. And this is, you know, you wouldn't have seen it. You would have seen it through a lens of some kind, a belief system. How can we ever drop? And I say Bud and Jay and David also have belief systems. I remember once Bud came over to the house and he wanted to go up to the roof of our apartment building to examine where the UFO was landing. And I thought to myself, this is silly. He doesn't understand this at all. He does not understand it. And yet, and I'm going to diverge a little bit and talk about something that happened in here this yesterday. This is, what's the date today? God knows. Okay, we're recording this on, I'm looking at my calendar right now, on the 9th of July. So this happened on the 8th. I was here working with somebody on a project. And I have been turning off my internet at night because I don't like to live in this stuff. And something very bizarre happened. He came in, the man that we're going to work with, I was going to work with, came in. We sat down to talk, perfectly normal conversation. But when it came time for him to leave a few hours later, when I opened the door, the lock had been dismantled while we were sitting there. And I thought, well, the doorbell camera will show who did it. Seconds after he came in, the battery in the doorbell camera was drained to nothing. And so there was no doorbell camera. Now, you would think, what is this about? Well, it was about two things. The first thing it was about was to show him what my life is like, what it is like to have these things happen, to have that experience with me. The second was a warning to me. You're vulnerable. Don't turn off your alarms at night. Leave it on. And then someone who's very psychic called me and jokingly in the conversation said, what if you're being stalked by a death cult? And I'm probably not being, but that was psychic reinforcement to be more careful. See what happened? In other words, it looks like a very negative thing. Take apart the lock and someone trying to break in later, but it's not. It's a communication from another level of reality that I recognize as such. Now, this type of recognition is happening to thousands of people all over the world, and especially in the West. We're waking up to the presence of a consciousness that isn't part of the material world, but can dip into it and affect it. Okay, so I'm sorry to diverge, folks, but this is important, and it fits with what Keith is thinking and talking about very much. Now, I want to ask you, how do you react to a story like that, Keith, based on all you know about this phenomenon?
Well, a couple of things I would bring into the conversation. Let's go back to John Mack. As you know, at the time that he got interested in the subject, he had befriended Dr. Stanislav Grof at Esalen Institute and had begun to explore beyond his, this is very important. He was trained as a Freudian, traditional, secular, agnostic, or in his family's case, atheist, materialist scientist. He did not have any orientation to larger states, expanded states of awareness. He did a form of self-inquiry, self-exploration that Dr. Grof and his late wife, Christina Grof, developed called holotropic breathwork, holotropic moving toward wholeness. The idea is simply to enter into a controlled form of breathing and enter an expanded state of consciousness where it turned, we often call it an altered state of consciousness. I think that's an unnecessary pejorative. It opens to a larger state. So Dr. Mack continued to be the empirical researcher that he was, and because he found himself exploring states of consciousness that he did not know existed, he did not automatically dismiss those. He said, there's more here. I committed myself as a scientist of the mind to go where the evidence leads me, not to exclude it, take it off the table. So it's a kind of roundabout way. He was open. He began to explore into realms that abduction research had not, and found that in many cases, there was a he was the first to really introduce the fact that there was a transformational dimension to this, to the abduction phenomenon. These are tough form of tough love. I think he at one point referred to the abduction as a form of therapy, as a form of attention for the cognitively impaired or the metaphysically impaired. He said, if they're having to go to these lengths to get our intention, maybe it's telling us something about ourselves that we're missing the more subtle elements of it. So the kind of description you're indicating, it's this line between mind and matter, and sometimes parapsychological dimensions absolutely create phenomena like broken locks and breaking through systems, breaking through physical systems. It happened to the Hills in their home, and it happened to the Arnolds in their home.
The weird thing was, in this case, the screws that held the locks tongue housing into the wall had been replaced with screws that were smaller than the, and therefore when you open the door, the housing just fell off. And that housing's been there since the building was built. It's not new. And the screws were brand new. It had happened that morning while we were sitting in the living room a few feet away and we didn't notice. That's just brain bending. How did they do it? And the answer is they did something to these heads, to my head and to his head. That we have missing time. I don't see anything in the video of the conversation between us that indicates that. I mean, we don't stop at any point, but somehow this was done. And you know, I'm pretty sure it was done by people, and I think I may even know some of them a little bit, and they're not normal people at all. They're people with different powers and different concerns, and they were concerned for my safety, and that's why they did it. And they did it when he was there to illustrate to him exactly what he wants to know. He's writing a thing about me and what's it like to be Whitley. And this is a good example of what it's like to live in what my friends call the unquiet flat, because it's very unquiet around here for sure. Anyway, so this is part of this ontological shock that we're going to all be experiencing more and more, and that you've got a handle on. And I want to get into the abduction phenomenon, but I want to skip ahead to another chapter first, because you talk about new scientific paradigms that bridge the gap between mind and matter, the exact gap we're talking about. Can you tell us a little bit more about what you mean by this and what your vision is?
Well, it's simply, let me try to keep it simple. I pay a great deal of attention to Dr. Carl Jung in this book, and his own development. He tried very hard when he broke from Freud. Here was the basic disagreement between Freud and Jung, and this is important. It builds on the case. Freud was the first to say, at least in the modern era, the conscious life is like a little tip of the iceberg. There's this deep unconscious. But all Freud thought the personal unconscious, which was the unconscious per se, the unconscious was simply personal. It is all the stuff that we repress. It is all the stuff that Keith doesn't want to deal with, Whitley doesn't want to deal with at the ego self level, things we're embarrassed about. We put it down into the personal unconscious. And the job of good psychotherapy, good inner exploration, is to find the permission to say, I'm going to include those impulses in myself that I might be embarrassed about. And lo and behold, when we do include that material in our lives, in our conscious life, we find greater facility. We move through life more freely. So Jung took it one step further, and this is where they broke. He said to his friend Sigmund Freud, Sigmund, there's more to this unconscious than personal violence, you know, sex and violence in the Victorian era, which is what Freud was nearly obsessed with. There's what I call a collective unconscious that contains all the mythological elements, all the historic elements. We all have access to this realm. So that was his first big discovery. The second thing he discovered and popularized was this idea of synchronicity. There are meaningful connections between psychic states and the physical world. So he extrapolated this to say, Whitley, Keith, all of us, we know that consciousness is what is the primary experience of our lives. And that the fact that we are aware of anything at all, and the fact that these synchronicities happen across the divide between mind and matter, that the synchronicities are part, that we live in the collective unconscious. So what I think we are dealing with the UFO phenomenon, at least one way to talk about it, is just as there's a return of what is suppressed in the personal psyche, when the person is seen to live in psyche, when psyche and psychic processes are seen to be at large in the world, then we're now seeing the return of something more material from the larger realm of reality is making its way into our accepted reality. The constraints, in other words, I call them coherence constraints. We all have constraints on what we consider coherent or plausible. If you've had an abduction experience, it's safe to say your definition of what is coherent or plausible has suddenly changed. Not because you started out with a belief. You wouldn't have preferred to believe in abductions, I think it's fair to say. But you had an experience which brought, which loosened your constraints against refusing that. That, I think, is what is happening. Even in the Pentagon's recent acknowledgement, they now call them UAP, unidentified aerial phenomena, partly to get around the stigma of UFO. Fine, call it what we want. There's even an official now recognition that a great many of these, we now have officially unexplained phenomena. I know that seems a small step, but I think what we're seeing is a gradual loosening of the coherence constraints, allowing there to be recognition. These events happen. I'm going to speak of it. Other people have the similar events they can speak of. It's the normalizing of something that I think we're living through right now. I've often said, this is the way things go when we stop teaching Dante in public education. What do I mean by that? Dante had a universe or a cosmos that was richly layered with layers of forms of intelligence, different kinds of beings. We in modern secular materialism have reduced the inner life to a very small part inside the human. We've isolated spirit and consciousness inside the human and closed off much. So therefore, the phenomena that Dante and the religious people of the Middle Ages lived with, they lived with knowledge that there were angels and demons, good ones and bad ones, friends and foes. You know, it's not to say they had the final word on it, but they didn't assume that the human was the center of the cosmos.
But, you know, I live with that too. So do you. I mean, I live with it physically. I lived with it yesterday, physically. And but in what way was it a physical experience? Certainly the lock was changed very strangely, but done in a way that I could not say this was an accident, because you can't fix the lock with the hardware that is there now. Right. It's not, you have to get new hardware.
You know, the word to apply to that as a general term, that is an anomaly. Now, what do I mean by an anomaly? That's
There's
a good term.
Because, around here.
As no, you I, know, Thomas Kuhn, the philosopher of science, great philosopher of paradigms and paradigm shifts, the idea of worldviews, how a worldview is coherent. It stands up to muster. It seems to explain enough of reality most of the time to work, except what happens many times in history, as with Galileo, when he looked into the sky, used his computations to conclude, oh, minor detail, the Earth orbits the sun, not the other way around. He began to talk about this. He got a knock on the door. It was from the Vatican. They said, Galileo, we hear you're saying these kinds of crazy things. He says, you don't have to take my word for it. Look through my telescope. He had an invention. They said, we're not looking at your telescope. We're here to tell you, if you don't stop saying the Earth, if you don't stop reporting observations empirical, you call them. If you don't stop this, we'll place you under house arrest. He didn't stop. He was placed under house arrest. Kuhn later, the author of The Structure of Scientific Revolution, said, a paradigm stands up to muster, stands up to challenge until enough anomalies begin to accumulate. And scientists then have to begin putting out the fires. It was easy to explain the near-death phenomenon at first. Oh, it just must be a brain function, a brain pattern that goes off when people are dying. It's just a pleasant neurological phenomenon. But there are too many aspects of the near-death experience, including non-local perceptions of surgeons in the other part of the hospital whose patients report what happened in ways that could not have been reported. So these anomalies, near-death, UFO, abductions, the whole body of parapsychological research, there's been a growing body of anomalies. And finally, the mainstream paradigm has to do a shift. It has, and there is a shift. It says there are so many anomalies now, they have to be accommodated. And what generally happens, Whitley, you talked about us being in the later part of our life now. It is, as one of the philosophers said, it is science advances one funeral at a time. Namely, as the old order dies off, those who deny that these anomalies have any meaning, a new generation who might have, for example, have had experimentation with alternative therapies, with nature, with psychedelics, but who have just a near-death experience, studied the phenomena, they come to realize, well, we don't have to reject the phenomena that don't fit. We can incorporate them into the paradigm. So I think that's what the new paradigm consists of isn't clear, but there is a new paradigm emerging, and it will simply include more of these so-called anomalies, and then there'll be future anomalies. Fine, that's how knowledge grows.
Well, you know, exactly, but we're in a situation where somebody's really pounding on the door. In other words, how many people nowadays have had UFO sightings? Back in the 50s, you know, it was just a smattering of people. Now it's an ordinary thing. I hardly ever talk to anyone who hasn't had at least one UFO sighting. And many, many people have had close encounters. It's just absolutely amazing. And, you know, I all the time end up with talking to people who had incredible close encounters, and they just live with them. I mean, they don't write about them or anything, because they're becoming a part of ordinary life is what's happening. And people think that in the UFO world, they were looking for a moment of official disclosure. But there is a kind of disclosure going on. It is that this phenomenon is becoming part of ordinary life.
People say to me, Keith, do you deal with disclosure in your book? And I sometimes put my hand over my face, take a deep breath. The whole book is about disclosure. The phenomenon is disclosing itself. No, I don't deal specifically with the details of the disclosure process. Although, as you pointed out, I did have the opportunity. I took a phone call one day, surprisingly, from Lawrence Rockefeller, who had developed an interest in this phenomenon. He had decided to use his considerable civic influence to work with President Bill Clinton and First Lady Hillary Clinton, who had expressed some interest and invited me to a gathering at the J.Y. Ranch in Wyoming with John Mack and some other researchers, and invited me to participate in this effort to lobby the Clinton administration to get greater disclosure specifically on Roswell. As you know, the government checked its records. We've looked in our files, Mr. Rockefeller, we've found nothing. And then the scenario that you touched on earlier, Whitley, suddenly all of the Roswell stuff, including 3 years prior to the crash of whatever it was that crashed out there, all the files disappeared. There was something.
And illegally disappeared. They're not supposed immediately. To.
It's like pushing a button. If there was a simple delete button, the delete button, and as somebody pointed out, well, they went 3 years before the event happened. That's called covering your tracks. I don't know what they were trying to cover their tracks for. Something happened. It was not a meteorological balloon.
No. Well, you know,
to say the least.
There's a facility in Woodstock, New York, run by EG&G Rotron, that is connected to the Iron Mountain storage facility, which is farther south in Rosendale, New York. And I think that a lot of these records have been offloaded to Rotron, where they become, they've been given to these companies, this company and probably others in other parts of the country. And they are now in private hands. They're outside of the freedom of information doesn't apply because they're not in public, they're not public property anymore. That's illegal. It's been done illegally, but this whole thing is being covered up illegally from top to bottom. It's all illegal.
Well, and when that's very much at the heart of the allegations, which is what they are, by David Grush, which, I mean, we can't go deeply into that, but he's a former retired military intelligence official with very strong credentials in every other area. He's done some research. He's delivered names, dates, and locations to the inspector general about material that is apparently exactly as you say, offloaded into the aerospace companies. Now, yes, maybe there is such stuff. He's been told there is such stuff. On that, I have no doubt. I don't have doubt about his credibility. He's also asked himself, because he's a smart cook, you got a smart guy. He said, I'm aware that they may be telling me what I want to hear. Well, I'm going to do some double checking. So he did some cross confirmation because he said, maybe I'm being used as a disinformation tool. So he's done the kind of investigating. I don't know that's there. I can't vouch for what may be in the hangars at McDonnell Douglas and Lockheed Martin, but that would be another example of plausible deniability. The government can say, no, we don't have anything like that, but maybe McDonnell Douglas does. And then what, by the way,
it doesn't say the species doesn't, because I think we do.
But another interesting part of what David Grush has said is he said, I'm not claiming that I'm told it was extraterrestrial. People said, well, you're talking about physical objects. He said, I'm saying it's been described as other dimensional potential. Well, okay, it might be that very difficult. What is extraterrestrial? What is other dimensional? You know, this phenomenon, as you know, there's a theory called the ultra-terrestrial theory, that this phenomenon may be in some sense part of a parallel Earth phenomenon. They're seen very often coming out of water, going into bodies of water. This is 3/4 of this planet is water. So we think of
it's 5 miles near where they come and go all the time.
Yeah. So it's the origins issue is not the primary question. You know, I'm going to touch on one thing. Since you and I have been at this for a while, I've been struck how 2017, the New York Times article, you know, describing the Pentagon's interest and their secret research that they claimed they weren't doing on a phenomenon they claimed didn't exist. That has had a lot of impact on the new generation of people paying attention to this, millennials and Gen Z. And what I think many of them don't realize, they think, oh, because the New York Times is finally covering this, that must mean that disclosure of the kind we're talking about is imminent. So we've got to get the government to release the secrets. Look, I'll meet anybody in that conversation. I'm all for greater transparency of the government. But as you and I also know, this idea that the lid on the government cover-up is about to blow sky high has been part of the story for 8 decades. It doesn't mean we should ignore it.
It's been ever since the Hillenkoetter congressional hearings, where Hillenkoetter testified back in, I think, 1963 or something.
Exactly. This has been
about to happen. But
All I can say is to the younger ones who are new to all of this.
Let me finish forming my question.
Okay, sure. I thought you were done.
14 administrations have said no. 14 administrations have refused to disclose. Some of them, when they've been pressed, have done so on a point blank basis. The Obama administration, for example, and the Biden administration have refused on a point blank basis. The Carter administration, he went in saying he was going to tell everything, and he told nothing. And then when Stanton Friedman, after he was out of the White House, asked him what if he had anything further to say, he said, I do not wish to discuss it at all. And then we have things like, who was it who said that it was, that he had looked into it deeply and the secret was very somber. That was Lou Elizondo.
Yes, yes.
And that there is something being hidden that's of extraordinary, epical, life-changing importance. There's no question in my mind about it. And if whether or not they're hiding it because it's simply so overwhelming, or they're hiding it because this other presence is forcing them to hide it, I don't know. But this other presence is real, it is very strange, and it's right here, right now.
It could even be in the list of scenarios it would need to include, not as necessarily all explanatory, but the hypothesis that goes like this. Can you imagine if this, it may very well be that part of what is being hidden is the fact that this is so unbelievably inexplicable that it pertains to something that we cannot master. We don't understand. When was the last time the government has ever held a news conference to acknowledge something inexplicable is in our skies with impunity, performing all of these trajectories that we can't account for? We don't know what it is. We'll keep you posted. They're not going to say that. So no. They might be, to some extent, hiding their own ignorance, because if there would be ontological shock, it would be that kind of acknowledgement that the government saying there's something that we don't know and we're not the top of the food chain, to use the often used phrase. That could be part of it. Could be also be that there is knowledge of aspects of this. There's a lot of speculation that is often very loose, however. For example, that we formed treaties and they said they told them they could abduct a certain number. I mean, I know you've heard of all of that, and there may be more evidence.
All that. There's no there. I mean, these are just rumors as far as I can tell. However, I do know they knew about the abductions in 1988. Whether that information is still available to people within the intelligence community and the administration, I don't know. But they did know then, and the reason I'm certain of that is that a very highly placed man in the alphabet world, Dr. David W. Webb, who was also a leading expert in space sciences, befriended me and Anne before Communion. I mean, this is 1986, before Communion was even, while it was being written, and came to the cabin and introduced me to an allergist who gave me allergy medication that was designed to minimize allergic reaction to the visitors if the physical showed up physically. And obviously he knew all about it, and he must have, or he was being sent by somebody who did, because if you look at David W. Webb on Wikipedia, you find he's a very highly placed guy. He was the sweetest man in the world and so encouraging. I would say that this is still happening. He'd say, Whitley, do as much as you can to get them to come back to you. And so on some level, there must be records of that. Where are they, though? Offloaded into the defense industry somewhere, I would guess. But here's the thing. How can the Air Force ever admit that its most basic job, protecting the public from threats from above, it cannot do? And when it comes to the abductions, they can't do it. They can't. Dr. Webb had no idea how it was happening, what was going on. There were things that would happen, like after an abduction, there would be this strange plane that would fly around the circle at very high altitude the next morning for a couple of hours, around and around. You could hear it up there. It was a prop plane buzzing. But if you looked at it, the wings looked like sticks with long engine nacelles on them. They did not look like it could fly. In fact, one physicist who came up when it and saw it when it was there literally went like this when he saw it, because it felt to him like it was going to fall out of the sky. So who was that in that plane? And why did it, you know, did Dr. Webb know about it? I just don't know any of these things. I can't answer any of these questions.
Well,
okay, go ahead.
There's so many ways to go, and I know we're nearing the end of our time. I would just, I want to repeat a young Emily Trim from Zimbabwe Aerial School. She was able to get out of that in-between marginal space and at least bring this phase of her initiation to closure by speaking out and going back to school, meeting with her friends, meeting with the spiritual teacher who said, come forward and tell your story. By the way, her parents had begun to loosen up their own coherence restrictions and began to say, we've lived with you long enough, my dear. We're more open to what happened to you. So that's an example of a return. You know, Joseph Campbell talked about the return from an initiatory process beginning with separation from normal reality, long period in the wasteland, and then a final conclusion is you return with a boon, B-O-O-N, which refers to a reward or an insight or a teaching. Well, she brought back information which has made her a better artist. She's a graphic artist. And the one of the two witnesses of the famous Pascagoula case, who I write about in the book, Calvin Parker. Do you know what he literally did? You may know because you've read my book. He not only did not want any publicity after he came forward with this, he literally changed his name. Informally, he introduced himself to new people as somebody named Randy. He didn't want to be the Calvin Parker. And it was only when he went to a funeral and he mistakenly signed the register Calvin Parker, and the person behind him said, you're Calvin Parker? You're the guy who got abducted? And Calvin said, oh, no, I signed my real name. And at that point, they said, we've got to leave. He and his wife said, we've got to leave. We can't turn this man's funeral into a discussion of my abduction. And on the way to the parking lot, his wife said to him, Calvin, it's time. You've got to write your book. And he'd had an invitation from a publisher to write his book. Finally, by publishing the book under his own name, he was able to say goodbye to Randy, an identity that was never his. He was able to complete the journey, and new witnesses came out in the last 5 years in the Pascagoula case. So that brings me to a point people often say to me when they find out I'm doing this and they find out it's okay to tell me what they've had happen in their own life. Should I tell anyone is the question I get asked. So partly with your experience in mind, you told everyone. You wrote a book. You chose a very brave and bold and perhaps foolhardy course. But you, as far as I can tell, you haven't looked back. You may have had some moments of regret, but you've kept moving forward. I tell people, don't tell everyone. Tell somebody in your life who you love and who loves you. Begin to share it. And because you've got to get this out into a realm beyond your own psyche, because the psyche will work on this in a way that is not productive. So begin to share it with someone in your life, someone you love, loves you. Maybe it's a religious person, maybe it's not, like a preacher, a priest, so forth. That may not be the course for everybody. But don't hold on to it alone. Begin to communicate with others.
Now, I think that's a great place for us to conclude our discussion. Because we, you know, a lot of listeners are people who are thinking about doing this very thing right now. And remember, you don't have to go on TV. You just have to find someone who you can trust, who you can talk to in order to advance your own journey. Because it's an initiatory journey, not just for mankind. And we're being initiated into a new world. Like they said to Phil Corso, what's on offer is a new world if you can take it.
Well, and you know, as I said, I define the UFO as a kind of a metaphoric but very tangible call from the cosmos. Something is communicating with us, but until you respond to a call, it's only a monologue. So now we're being asked to respond to the call. How will we respond? As individuals, we're describing, share it with someone else. That's one way to respond to the call. and open yourself to the call and understand there may be something that is moving through you that you don't understand, your religion didn't teach you about, your moral systems didn't teach you about, but you're not going to shut the door on it. And the larger, as you say, there's a collective initiation we're going through with all of these phenomena. These anomalies are on the board and they're not going to go away.
Keith Thompson, The UFO Paradox, thompsonatlarge.com, a deep thinker, but more importantly, an effective thinker. Keith knows what he's doing. He does it well. You know, we didn't talk about one thing, and we've actually got a few minutes left. We go an hour and a half, so I was going to conclude it, but we have to get into another area. Michael Murphy and Esalen, and the fascinating material in Chapter 8 called "Who Do We Think We Are?" Who do we think we are? And because there are human capacities that we don't use that are directly relevant to making this make sense. Can you speak to that?
Let me give you one example. This is officially called just nothing but a coincidence. The phone rings. And for some reason, as you cross the room to go find your phone, these days we don't know where our phones are half the time because they can be different places. You have a feeling, you say, oh, I have not heard from Mary Ellen in high school. God, I wonder why I just thought of her. So you go pick up the phone. It's Mary Ellen from high school. You haven't been in touch with her for 20 years. That's officially nothing but a coincidence, but it's one of those breakthroughs between realms. I'm going to give you, and so there are so many examples of what Michael Murphy in his masterful book called The Future of the Body, extraordinary capacities of everyday life. Now, here's a good example. In the Zimbabwe sighting, there was widespread discussion of the children had communicated telepathically with the aliens. And everybody focused on, oh, what did the aliens communicate telepathically? I thought, am I the only one who's noticing that for telepathy to exist, for it to occur, then the capacity must exist in the girls, maybe for the first of the girls, the students. At the school. Maybe it was the first time their telepathic capacities had been triggered. The aliens didn't invent telepathy and insert it in their heads. They communicated with them telepathically, clairvoyance, and other precognitive dreams. We are sitting on exceptional capacities. So in the chapter that you described, Chapter 8, I use the title rhetorical question. Who do we think we are? Who do we imagine ourselves to be if we open to these capacities that are called paranormal in a responsible, grounded way? We are already meeting these beings on shared ground. So for the very experience of abduction, for example, to register as an experience for you, Whitley, it means that if you were moved through the sky or moved through the roof or moved through the wall, it means that you are, that what you call Whitley is different from what you had thought you were. It wasn't just that the alien somehow managed to levitate someone through a wall. It's that the form of travel that involve, to what extent, are subtle bodies, the subtle bodies, subtle material bodies. So there, as you say, there's a whole realm of exceptional human capacities. Great athletes often call it being in the zone. They hear special music. They feel they know telepathically where to throw the ball. It's remarkable. It's just remarkable. And yet we live in these capacities, and they live us if they live through us. And if we don't, they manifest in all sorts of psychophysical diseases. Jung said the gods are now diseases. If we don't live with the larger energies that we call gods, they will invade us as diseases and disorders. That's a sobering way to go out, but it's a call to open to our greater potential.
But this potential is what we have to find. This is what the whole, this, because this is an initiation on a personal level. It's also the initiation of the whole species. We are in the second stage of an initiatory event of enormous importance, a fundamental initiation, because it is initiation into a larger reality. To bring it, someone is trying to bring us into this other way of being, because apparently they believe we're ready.
Somewhere today, there'll be a news story, Whitley, about the placebo effect, a new study that showed the placebo effect. Here's an example, that the group is divided into two, experimental group and a control group. Nobody knows who's getting the real medicine. Nobody knows who's getting the dummy pills. A significant, statistically significant number of those who take the dummy medicine but don't know it report the benefits of the medicine and the side effects. And the medical people, when they're interviewed at the bottom of the article, say, oh, that's just the placebo effect. Never mind. Just the placebo effect? If we would understand the placebo effect, where the capacities of mind are evoked simply because you believe you may have gotten the medicine to make you better, and you may have actually gotten the side effects too, it tells us that these larger anomalies around UFOs and near death, it may be part of the larger pattern. That we're living in a universe that's larger than we know. We're getting news from the universe. Let's open to it and evaluate it. We don't have to say yes to all of it. We just need to evaluate that we're getting the news. Otherwise, we're living with our heads in the ground like ostriches. And that generally doesn't work out well, especially for the ostriches, when the predators come and their heads are in the ground.
Right. Keith Thompson, thank you for being with us. And once again, I'll mention the UFO paradox. A very fine book that will expand your mind. Thank you, and I hope to see you quite soon again at the conference or somewhere, because we have a lot of fun together.
Well, thank you, Whitley. I look forward to seeing you again, too, and thanks so much for the invitation.
You've been listening to Dreamland. Be sure to tune in again next week. Dreamland is brought to you by UnknownCountry.com and its family of subscribers. Our theme music is The O of Pleasure by Ray Lynch. Unknown Country was founded by Ann Strieber. Our news editor is Matthew Frizzell. Our coordinator is Amy Safrankova. Whitley Strieber is your Dreamland host. And I'm your announcer, Ted Alexander.